This is The Takeaway for Friday, February 10th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks for listening. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in another round of the Trump White House versus the judiciary upheld a temporary restraining order preventing President Trump's seven-country travel ban from being enforced, which means refugees, visa holders, and other travelers from the seven majority Muslim countries who have their legal documents in order can keep entering the United States at this time. But for how long? See you in court. The security of our nation is at stake, said President Trump on Twitter. But here is what Bob Ferguson, Washington State's attorney general, said.
In response to the president's tweet, well, we have seen him in court twice, and we're two for two. That's number one.
Attorney General Ferguson brought this suit along with the state of Minnesota. We go back now to Leon Fresco, former deputy attorney, assistant attorney general at the Justice Department, where he was head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under the Obama administration, to help us understand where we stand. Leon Fresco, welcome back.
Thank you, John.
Now, does the court say that there's something wrong with the president's paperwork here on this executive order, that he doesn't have the authority to do this, or that the security of the government is not at stake in this executive order? What's going on here?
Well, there are multiple layers of what the court said was wrong with the executive order. The first was there was a claim made by the government that the executive order had been rescinded insofar as it applied against lawful permanent residents. And the court ruled that no, it had not been rescinded, because what happened was the White House counsel had attempted to make a clarification to the executive order. And the court said that the White House counsel is unable to do that because the White House counsel is not in the chain of command of the agencies that would have to implement this order, which are the Homeland Security Department and the State Department. And so only the president himself could actually rescind his own guidance, or at least the Secretary of Homeland Security or the Secretary of State could do it, but the White House counsel could not do it. So that was the paperwork issue. And in terms of where the analysis from the courts came, when they made the analysis of the private harms versus the public harms, the court made an analysis that the private harms, which was all of the things we were seeing at the airports with people being detained and the uncertainty regarding green card holders and visa holders, outweighed the public harms because there was not enough evidence in this record that the seven countries at issue had supplied any terrorist attacks in the recent history of the United States. And so there was not a justification for this immediate, complete ban of travel, as opposed to an individualized analysis where someone could make their case why they should be allowed to travel.
All right, so 2 points there. Number one, this is the first time that the federal judiciary has actually critiqued this style of President Trump using these executive orders to make all kinds of judgments. It just so happens that in the paperwork issue, as you describe and as I described, there's a sort of a mess up here that Trump doesn't seem to understand how things get done. And that's partly what the court was criticizing or ruling on, correct?
Yes, that's correct. The court said that if the president is going to issue an executive order, then either the president or someone in the actual chain of command of the agents who have to implement this order have to rescind the order. It cannot be the White House counsel, because the White House counsel is not in the chain of command. And so the president would have had to change the order himself, which it seems from all accounts he was not inclined to do.
All right. So that potentially has wide implications to a lot of stuff that's been going on since the inauguration. All right, let's put that aside. Now, on this question of the trade-off of harm to individuals who are stuck at airports, stuck at humanitarian agency offices, stuck in refugee camps, perhaps, with their paperwork in order, who might be affected by this ban, that is more of a harm than what the Trump administration demonstrated in court or offered in court as evidence of a security concern in the United States. Did the Trump administration just have bad evidence? Did they say they didn't have to apply any evidence? Did they supply evidence and the court said that's ridiculous? What was going on there?
Well, there was no evidence in the district court record of a particularized set of findings that the administration looked at in order to make these seven countries subject to the travel ban. They simply were relying upon the fact that Congress had passed a statute that did not allow people from those seven countries to enter on the visa waiver program in order to now designate them for a complete travel ban. But what the court was taking exception to was the fact that there was not specific evidence in the record that led for that judgment to be made for a complete travel ban. And so when they asked the attorney for the government during the oral argument what evidence there was, the attorney said that the case was moving too quickly for evidence to be placed into the record. And so that was something that the court did not take too lightly.
So the Trump administration is kind of asserting a sort of executive privilege here by saying, oh, we don't have to do that, folks. Leave us alone. This is national security. And the court said, whoa, get out of town.
Well, yeah, I mean, I always try to keep my language as formal as possible, but that is another way to describe what happened. Certainly.
But it certainly explains the unanimity here in the three-judge circuit, right?
Yes. I mean, that I think is the most remarkable part of the decision, which is if you listen to the argument in the case, you thought there might be a chance for either a narrowing of the executive order or perhaps a 2-1 decision. But I think at the end of the day, what carried the decision to make it a 3-0 unanimous decision was this concept that the ban itself was not justified by any immediate exigencies that would have required this complete, basically, elimination of due process where an individual could not make their case as to why it was significant that they could travel to the United States. What, you know, if somebody had a medical procedure that needed happen the next day or something. And so that was the problem.
Well, my mind is racing here. There's so much to cover. All right, let me get at the issue of, is there a specific legal test that administrations or anyone has to meet on questions like this, like clear and present danger, that sort of thing, when you're trying to say, hey, there's a national security issue at stake?
Well, so this is what the Supreme Court is going to analyze, because the Ninth Circuit has been, to be fair to the Trump administration, the Ninth Circuit has been a little bit of an outlier here, where the Ninth Circuit has been trying to be the leader of a movement to say all immigration orders are reviewable. It doesn't matter what kind of order it is. That is not exactly where the immigration law is today. There is some precedent, and it definitely is Supreme Court precedent that goes back over 100 years, that there are some issues that are simply unreviewable because the way the framers set up the system when the Congress and the president executed a statute like the one that's at issue here, that makes it a political issue that is no longer subject to the judicial review. And so the Ninth Circuit has been pushing back very heavily on that and saying, well, no, that's not true. Everything must have some level of review. And so the first thing that the Supreme Court's going to have to decide is there a level of review? And then if there's a level of review, what deference is given to the government in these decisions? And so what the Ninth Circuit said is there is significant deference given to the government, but even with that significant deference, there was nothing in this record to defer to. So that's why there's not a likelihood of success on the government's part.
All right, guys. So this issue helps me to understand why on right-wing radio or talk radio, there have been screaming hosts saying that this insane Ninth Circuit is offering due process 14th Amendment protections to people who aren't even Americans, and that's crazy. What you're saying is a civilized and decorous way of explaining what the issue is that the Supreme Court's going to have to decide.
Correct. This has been a tension that's been boiling in the courts for about 20 years, and the Supreme Court has been very, very reluctant to once and for all offer guidance as to the different levels of due process that different individuals who are in different stages of the immigration process have in the United States. What is the level of due process someone outside of the United States has? What is the level that someone who just crossed the border and was apprehended has? What is the level that someone who's been here 20 years but illegally has? And all of those are debates that the Supreme Court has been very reluctant to weigh in. And so this may be the case where the Supreme Court actually has to start setting some principles about who has due process rights, under what circumstances, and what are the nature of those rights.
All right, finally and quickly, or as quickly as you can, what does the 4-4 court mean in trying to decide that argument? And can you tell us anything important about the three members of the Ninth Circuit panel?
Well, so if you remember what I was telling you Monday, I had predicted that this would happen, that they were that this order would that the stay would continue, because this particular panel, just in my time litigating with the Ninth Circuit, I had not seen any sort of significant reason to think that this panel, that these specific panel members would have some affinity toward the government's argument in this case. Now, going up to the Supreme Court, it's going to be complicated because, again, as I explained to you earlier in the week, we had the exact same problem in the Texas DAPA case in 2014 on standing, where the four who are called so-called liberal judges thought Texas did not have standing, and the four conservative judges thought Texas did have standing. And so the question that's in my mind is everybody going to flip the script, or will someone stay consistent on this issue about whether states have standing or not to challenge immigration laws?
Thanks so much for reminding us of all of that. Leon Fresco is former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department, where he was head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under the Obama administration. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Now, it may sound a little like gossip and Kardashian nonsense to hear the difficulties of Ivanka Trump and her troubles selling her lines of fashion products and the president defending her.
Who's been a champion for women empowerment, sure. Women in the workplace, to get to him. I think people can see through that.
30
go
seconds.
Go buy Ivanka's stuff is what I would tell. I'm going to go get some on myself today.
But it's not Kardashian nonsense. This appears to be a huge compromise of the presidency on ethical grounds. Counselor to the president Kellyanne Conway's statement there on Fox motivated a serious rebuke, apparently, from inside the White House. Here's what White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said.
Kellyanne has been counseled, and that's all we're going to go with. She's been counseled on that subject, and that's it.
But members of the Trump team, other than Conway, may also need some counseling in the coming weeks, as that was far from the only potential conflict of interest that the Trump administration has been in the news for this week and may be in the news for going forward. We turn to Kathleen Clark, professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis and government ethics expert.
So the principle is that public office must not be used for private gain. And that's a principle that's longstanding, and then it's expressed in this regulation, which prohibits federal employees, executive branch employees, from using public office to endorse or promote a brand or a product or an enterprise. And that's what Kellyanne Conway did on the television yesterday.
What response did the administration have to make in that particular instance?
So my understanding is that Sean Spicer indicated that Kellyanne Conway had been counseled.
What does that mean?
I'm not sure what it means in this situation. Sometimes what it means is someone is admonished, scolded. It can also mean someone is schooled on what the regulations are. And I actually think one good thing that could come out of this Kellyanne Conway Ivanka incident is if the Trump White House took steps to ensure that everyone in the White House, including the president, becomes familiar with the government ethics standards for the executive branch. It's not clear that they've studied them yet.
It seems that there may be an ethical difference between, you know, taking the administration and some you know, foreign leaders, say, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe of Japan to Camp David versus having them spend the weekend at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago in Florida. What do you think the principle is there?
I think it's completely reasonable for us to ask whether this particular side trip to Mar-a-Lago with the Japanese Prime Minister, why was Mar-a-Lago chosen? Why not Camp David? Why not a government facility that has hosted many foreign leaders in the past? Perhaps it's in the interest of the American public that they go to Florida and go to Mar-a-Lago. But because Trump has this conflict of interest, we cannot know whether he was motivated by his commercial, personal, financial interest, or whether he was motivated by a desire to help the American public and strengthen the U.S. relationship with Japan. That's why so many people, including myself, urged President Trump to disentangle himself, to divest from his commercial establishments so that we wouldn't be distracted by these concerns that he's just promoting himself rather than promoting the interests of the country.
You know, another on the list here that, again, evokes some of these principles that you've been talking about is, you know, discussions that the Department of Defense, you know, the Pentagon might actually have some New York office space rented out of the Trump Tower, where Donald Trump was, you know, actually being president-elect for much of the time after the election, as many people who attempted to drive down Fifth Avenue know very well.
Right. And so, on the one hand, it may be reasonable that the Defense Department wants some office space, some facility close to the president, President Trump, when he is in New York at Trump Tower. On the other hand, how can we be sure that this isn't yet another opportunity for the Trump Organization to maximize the amount of money that it extracts from the federal government? And it deserves some scrutiny, some close scrutiny in terms of both what the terms of the real estate deal will be, and also whether the Defense Department is accurately assessing its needs, or in fact, perhaps overestimating it at the, you know, in order to enrich Trump. This is a situation that needs to be looked at closely.
Now, this is the hard one for me, you know, as a journalist. You know, I want to do my job. I want to, you know, talk about the presidency. I want to be able to describe what's going on in Washington, all of that. You know, when you say it in that way, factually, it seems as though President Trump, who's in violation of the Constitution, that is a fact.
What I would say is what will happen will depend on what the people do. And I think as we could see in the last, you know, 48 hours, the people got concerned about the Ivanka tweets and the statements by Kellyanne Conway regarding Ivanka's brand. And the White House actually did respond and apparently acknowledged that there was a problem, that there was a violation, and arranged for Kellyanne Conway to be counseled. I think that incident is a significant one, but the Emoluments Clause issue is an even more significant one. And so what will happen will depend on the degree to which the public becomes as engaged on that as, frankly, it has become engaged on this Ivanka episode.
Kathleen Clark, professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis, also a government ethics expert. Thank you so much for speaking with us from Washington, D.C.
Thank you for the opportunity.
A pesar de la aprobación de una estrategia revisada,
hear those voices. The international community, diplomacy, the business of world politics runs on translation or interpretation of world leaders and their representatives in their various languages. And this can be a dicey business, demanding the utmost of precision. History is riddled with examples of translations gone wrong.
The most famous one is what's called the Ems Telegram. It was a message sent by Bismarck referring to the fact that the Kaiser of Germany had nothing more to say to the French ambassador. And in the telegram, he referred to an adjutant of the Kaiser. This was mistranslated in the French newspaper as adjutant, because the word in German referred to a pretty high-ranking courtier, and in French it means a low-ranking officer in the army. It completely misrepresented the level of formality and the level of politeness. It made the French government so very angry that it declared war on Germany. And that's how the Franco-Prussian War began in 1870.
That's David Bellows, a professor of French and Italian and comparative literature at Princeton. And he says it's up to translators all over the world to interpret President Donald Trump's language for foreign news consumers, which is not always an easy task. Bellows and Takeaway producer Alex Bodie spoke in English about some of the unique difficulties of translating the commander-in-chief.
What makes Trump especially difficult is the level, the register of his language, which is really not like that you usually find in international relations, diplomacy, and politics. English is a very tolerant language, and we tolerate all sorts of different varieties and registers. But in many languages around the world, I'm thinking particularly the ones I know, obviously, French and German, there's a level of discourse that is customary and normal for politicians and statesmen to speak, and Trump simply does not speak in that register. To speak in French in the register that Trump speaks in English is automatically to take your language out of the normal realm of politics and of statesmanlike discourse, which itself is a pretty dangerous thing to do.
So when you say register, what does that refer to here?
Well, the level of language, you know, level of politeness, level of formality. Trump typically uses short sentences, often fragmentary sentences, often exclamations. He doesn't use, you know, subordinate clauses. And it's that roughness of Trump's language. When I say it's dangerous to translate another language, I mean, it's dangerous to the translator. It sounds like you're being disrespectful, that you're not representing him in a way that is consonant with his position.
We have this clip of Donald Trump on Jimmy Kimmel during the campaign, and I just want to have your sort of reaction to it.
We have people coming into our country that are looking to do tremendous harm. You look at look at Paris, look at what happened in Paris. I mean, these people, they did not come from Sweden, okay? Look at what happened in Paris. Look at what happened last week in California with you know, 14 people dead. Other people going to die, they're so badly injured. I mean, we have a real problem. There's a tremendous hatred out there. And what I want to do is find out what, you know, you can't solve a problem until you find out what's the root cause. And I want to find out what is the problem, what's going on. And it's temporary. I've had so many people call me and say thank you. Now, if you remember, when I did that a week ago, it was like bedlam. All of a sudden, and you watch last night and you see people talking, they're saying, well, Trump has a point. We have to get down to the problem.
Okay, three things. One, as you heard in that clip, the president interrupts himself. He starts a sentence and then breaks off and starts another sentence. That's absolute hell for translating into anything like smooth or persuasive language in any other language. Also, it happens very fast. It doesn't take any voice pauses between them. Second, the topic structure of the whole speech is really difficult to work out as you go along because it keeps changing. And there is no clear outline. You can't give a summary of it point by point as to what he's saying because it switches from this to that to this to that. That's pretty hard for a translator to cope with, especially for doing it simultaneous or near simultaneous. But the third thing that, and this is actually fairly typical of all political discourse, but it's acute here, when he says, they didn't come from Sweden, did they? What you're meant to understand is something quite different from what he's said. What that means, I suppose, to the people Trump thinks he's addressing is they were Muslims or they were Arabs. Yeah? And you have to know enough about the mindset of Trump's audience to even guess what that means. Because in some other language, saying they didn't come from Sweden might mean they're Finns. And he doesn't mean they're Finns. Yes. Those kinds of allusions or implications or innuendos or the use of innuendo is really difficult to translate. And I wouldn't blame anybody from another language, another culture for getting that one wrong.
But David, President Trump can't be the only one who poses challenges for translators. What about other politicians?
That's right. Bad syntax, broken English, those aren't the only things that are really difficult to translate. People who use language supremely well are also difficult to translate as those who use it rather roughly. Churchill, at the time of the Battle of Britain, came out with this most wonderful, famous sentence that is so dense and so compact that it's really very hard to know how to say it in any other way.
Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
It's great in English. It's just, unfortunately, almost impossible to say that with elegance or, you know, that level of diction in a language like French, which it was very important to say it in at that time, since the French had just been defeated themselves. So, you know, that was a real tough one for whoever it was in the BBC, having to put that out in French straight away.
Okay, so then what do translators and interpreters do for the next 4 years if this is particularly difficult?
Well, there is no solution, so to speak, but I am sure that in the different capitals of the world, small teams of extremely clever and qualified people will, by dint of practice and doing more and more of this, get more and more the hang of how to cope with Trump, when to wait to see what the next sentence is going to be, when to abbreviate, when to avoid giving offense, and, you know, a certain expertise will grow up.
David Bellis, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for listening.
David Bellis is the director of the program in Translation and Intercultural Communication at Princeton University. He spoke with Takeaway producer Alex Bodie for this conversation.
Greetings and salutations. Welcome to the emergency line of the San Angeles Police Department. If you prefer an automated response, press 1 now.
No guns, no foul language, no red meat.
Land of the free.
Dallas Multipass.
You know how it is. Bump into each other, sparks happen. Anyway, we're in love.
Friday movie time. Time to talk to Rafer Guzman, the film critic for Newsday. Welcome, Rafer.
Hey, John.
So we've got some milestones here with the releases. First of all, 50 Shades Darker. For the people who are going to spend maybe $29 to see this in, you know, IMAX 3D. I don't know if that's even an option.
I hope not.
Is 50 Shades Darker 50, and is it darker?
Well, you know, you remember the first film. I always thought the first film was kind of a sort of non-erotic, sort of disappointingly cold, but not terrible romance.
That's 50 Shades of Grey, right?
That's 50 Shades of Grey. Right. Thank you. And this is supposed to be the much more kinkier, much more explicit version of that, where we get a little bit more into the red room and the dungeon and a few of the instruments that are used. But once again, I just think this is just so much worse than the first film. And my real complaint here is Christian Grey, this billionaire, is trying to seduce this young, post-college girl, Anastasia Steele. The thing is, he's a control freak. He's a bit of a stalker. He's super jealous. He gets her bank account information at one point.
Hey, stop. You're making me hot.
All right.
I brought you here to negotiate.
You're open to new terms.
No rules. No punishments.
No rules, no punishments, and no more secrets.
I can do that.
That is just really...
Listen, here's the problem with this film. If this guy were like a construction worker or an accountant who made $60,000 a year, Anastasia Steele would run screaming in the other direction. You'd have a restraining order against this guy. Any guy who's taking your bank account information and trying to whack you around in the bedroom is not a guy that you want to be with. But of course, he's a billionaire. So, you know, what's a few nipple clamps if you've got $1 billion coming your way? You know?
Oh, true love.
That's the real problem with this film to me.
All right. 50 Shades Darker is even worse than that. Movie number two, John Wick, Chapter 2. I kind of like this character, Keanu Reeves. Let's hear a clip.
He's offered $7 million for your life. $7 million is a lot of money, Mr. Wick.
So I guess you have a choice. You want a war? Or do you want to just give me a gun?
Somebody please get this man a gun.
Kind of a 21st century Clint Eastwood-y sort of thing. What do you think?
Yeah, that's Keanu Reeves and Lawrence Fishburne back again from The Matrix. The first film I thought was a little so-so, had some great action moments, but I wasn't that crazy about it. This film is so much better. It's
nice.
Like a major step up. And these are some of the best action sequences I have seen in years. It's
great.
A lot of fun. Keanu Reeves, I mean, you hear that delivery there. Only Keanu can do that. And this was a real surprise to me, and I really loved it.
And then there's the time we've lived in the world before we saw the Lego Batman movie and all the time after we've seen the movie, the Lego Batman movie.
It's the Batcave! Oh my gosh! 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 Batman! Whoa!
You're darn right, whoa!
The Lego Batman movie. Life changer.
You know, I was a huge fan of the Lego movie, as I know you were too, so I had high hopes for this. It doesn't have the same kind of sense of heart that the Lego movie did. It's much more about the jokes. There's a lot of Batman humor, a lot of references back to the old campy TV show. That's Michael Cera as Robin, Will Arnett is back as Batman. It's pretty funny, very entertaining.
Is Batman in this as good a character as Liam Neeson was in the Lego movie with the twisting head? dead cop.
Right. I mean, Batman was one of the better characters from the Lego movie. I love the idea of Batman as kind of an insufferable goth, you know, sort of married to his pain and so serious all the time. And, you know, he carries the movie this time, I would say. Again, it's not as emotionally appealing as the Lego movie was, but there's a lot of jokes. The humor is very smart, and I think parents and kids will be very pleased
I'm going. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee. Takeaway culture reporter Melissa Locker loves the Grammys, which get handed out this weekend, even if they get very celebrity heavy and there are entourages everywhere, which can make things a bit boring if you watch every minute. But superstar Beyonce leads the pack this year with 9 nominations. There's Drake, Rihanna, and Kanye West, not far behind, with 8 nods apiece. Melissa says right off the bat, it's Godzilla versus Megalon in the competition of Beyonce versus Adele. Both are nominated for several awards in the same categories, including Record of the Year, Song of the Year, and Best Pop Solo Performance.
They are just two megastars with two incredible albums. Adele's 25 had a couple standout hits, but my guess is that Beyonce could be taking the lead on this.
Hold up, they don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Back up, they don't love you like I love you. Step down, they don't love you like I love you.
Do you have a feeling about who's going to win?
Looking at the Album of the Year nominees is really interesting because you have Adele versus Beyonce,
right,
versus Justin Bieber,
right,
versus Drake, who are all 4 really well-known. And then there's one guy who is less well-known, super talented, but Sturgill Simpson was nominated for his album A Sailor's Guide to the Earth. It's kind of a Grammy curveball. Grammy voters love curveballs. So I think he is a total dark horse to completely take the Album of the Year category.
Let's hear the curveball here.
So go and live, live. Mountains riddle the sky. With this fever you ride. Make sure you give a little before you go to the great and on in the sky.
He's a country artist. And he is kind of alt country. He is making his way up the country charts, but he's not, you know, Garth Brooks or Miranda Lambert or Blake Shelton. And it's really interesting that he got thrown in there.
Bieber, any suspense?
Well, there's a good chance that he's going to win for his song Love Yourself, which I think would beat Beyonce, which would be impressive.
'Cause if you like the way you look that much, oh baby, you should go and love yourself. And if you think that I'm still holding on to something, you should go and love yourself.
But I think Ed Sheeran co-wrote that track, and Ed Sheeran won last year in the category. So maybe. I am absolutely not an Ed Sheeran fan, and I'm absolutely a Beyonce fan. So you know where I feel on that particular category.
So we may have 2 tributes, Prince and George Michael.
Right. And I think that while tributes are always very somber and people are going to be really missing these artists, their music was so joyful for the most part that I think it could actually make for kind of a big party. And I think these artists would both love to be recognized through their music and through kind of the love that they felt and the love that fans felt for them. So I think it could make it less of a somber occasion and more of a party.
The original soundtrack of Stranger Things is actually a big deal this year.
It is. The score for Stranger Things was by a band called Survive, which is a very synth band, and they have kind of that intense 80s synth vibe going for them.
It's the Melissa Locker vibe.
It really is. I am an intense 80s synth person. Soundtrack was divided up into 2 releases, and now the releases are actually going up against each other. So Grammy voters are going to have to stare down whether they like the first release better or the second half of the soundtrack better. And it should be kind of interesting to see whether the Grammy voters like throw up their hands or like, oh, forget it, I can't choose between these 2 masterpieces, or whether they come in and say, absolutely, the second half was way better than the first.
Melissa Locker, as a parent, can you watch the Grammys with your child?
Oh, absolutely. There is no reason you cannot watch the Grammys, except for the fact that they might get bored.
All right. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Have a good one.
You too.
Melissa Lockhart's culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and, of course, The Takeaway. Think about this. If you made the journey from South America seeking asylum in the United States, and after your experience here decided to walk through the dead of winter to get to Manitoba in Canada because of what happened to you in the United States, what would that say about the image of America as a sanctuary for asylum seekers? Well, the Canadian province of Manitoba has become a destination for asylum seekers who are fleeing from the United States on foot and crossing the U.S.-Canadian border illegally. Bashir Khan is an immigration and refugee lawyer based in Winnipeg, Canada. He's handled the claims of dozens of asylum seekers in recent months.
Presently, I have 17 refugee claimants, and I represent them, and all of them crossed the border from across the 49 parallel through an open field from the North Dakota to the Manitoba site.
First of all, how unprecedented is that in your view, and what do they say is the reason for them crossing the border?
In my view, it's absolutely unprecedented. I have been involved in this field for the last 7 years, and in the last seven winters, it is the first winter in which anyone has ever come to Manitoba. It's just deadly. People typically come when winter breaks in the spring, and they arrive until the late fall. It's unheard of that someone would come in the dead of winter like this. And why are they coming? Because they are desperate. They are desperate because Immigration and Customs Enforcement of the Department of Homeland Security was just about to remove them back to their respective countries in Africa. And they realized that Canada would be their last hope, their last chance to see if they could make a claim for refugee status.
So is it the case that they are seeking asylum not only from their home countries where they came from originally, but also asylum from ICE and customs in the United States?
Oh, no, they're not indicting the U.S. justice system in that way, no. But I have to tell you that I've heard some very disturbing stories that I was surprised to learn. So they start from Brazil and they travel northwards by land until they arrive in Mexico. And from Mexico, they arrive in the United States. And that's their first encounter with Americans. And so they make an asylum claim. They're immediately detained in the United States Immigration detention facility. They are not provided a legal aid lawyer. They don't have a lawyer. They have their United States Immigration Court hearing before an immigration judge at the detention facility, and they're denied. Why are they denied? Because they can't make long distance calls back to Africa to gather evidence to prove their claim. They don't even know what they have to do to prove their claim, because there's a serious access to justice issues for them. And that's why they end up losing their claim. And there's a United States Supreme Court decision that says that once a refugee claimant is rejected, within 6 months, they have to be paroled into U.S. society. And that's why they're released into the U.S. society pending deportation under strict reporting conditions to ICE, DHS. And that's when they make a break for it, because they realize perhaps in Canada they may get a fair hearing, which they feel they may not have necessarily had in the United States.
Bashir Khan, what do you say to people who might say, well, look, these people are unprepared. They should have had their papers. They should have had their phone numbers ready. They should have been ready to make their case. Instead, they aren't ready. They cross the border, and they're just coming to Canada because you're a bunch of softies up there.
I like to answer that question a different way, and I like to, for a moment, give you what I think should be the American perspective on things. Two of my refugee clients lost their hands. One of them has got only a thumb left, but lost 9 digits. The other claimant lost both hands. Why? Because they lost their gloves when they fell down in the snow, which is waist high, in an open farmer's field on the North Dakota-Manitoba border. And 7 hours in the snow and in the freezing cold and wind chill, very high wind chill. And so now they've had their hands amputated. So why did that happen? And I think I need to explain something to you. The Canada-United States Safe Third Country Agreement is against American interests. And I want this to be made known to your listeners. If people want to leave the United States, especially people who have no legal status in the United States and who are going to be deported anyway, And if they're self-deporting themselves before ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, deports them, and if they're self-deporting themselves to Canada, why is it that America has to take them back? Because that's what the agreement says. The agreement says that if these people from the United States entered at a land border crossing where it's a port of entry, which is a checkpoint on the Canadian side, Canada must return them back and America must take them back. Now, if U.S. was to withdraw from that agreement, A, these people would not be putting their lives at risk, and B, America would not be forced to take them back. So even it is in America's own national interest not to have this Safe Third Country Agreement. If people want to self-deport themselves out of the United States, it would be much easier for them if the United States wasn't forced to take them back. And that's why the Safe Third Country Agreement is a thorn, I think, on the side of even American interests.
That's great information. And boy, that's a tough story that you tell, Bashir Khan. Do you think that the Trump campaign, the presence of Trump in the political scene has transformed your experience as an immigration and refugee lawyer in Canada?
You know, the truth is, whatever President Trump is doing and has done, it's not affecting people who are presently in the United States. He's affecting those people who are presently outside of the United States. And these people who are now coming to Canada were subject to a deportation and removal order anyway. It was just a matter of time before they were deported from the United States. So to me, the presidency does not matter. These people were still in the same position. But the reason they left was because they were about to be deported. Not one of them told me it was because of President Trump they're leaving. And they're telling me the truth. They're leaving because a single officer of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement told them, you know what? We've just sent 104 of your countrymen in a jumbo jet last week. Get ready. That's what freaked them out, and that's why they came here. I think the presidency doesn't matter in this regard, and so we shouldn't put too much blame on President Trump, because his policies are not directly right now affecting asylum seekers who are presently in the United States already.
Bashir Khan is an immigration and refugee lawyer speaking to us from Winnipeg in Manitoba, Canada. Thank you so much.
Okay, sir. Thank you. Bye-bye.
So could you make it in the world like your parents did when they were your age? From West Palm Beach, Florida, yes, I am in fact following in my father's footsteps exactly. And once I graduate, will likely be making more than he did. You've been exploring the difference between the generations and their income potential in this economy of the 21st century. Skip tweets. My dad supported wife and two kids on a teacher's salary and bought a house in San Francisco. No way could we afford to do that now.
Hi, I'm a California girl. My parents had a lot going on. They weren't born in America, but they were able to go to college and have careers and have children. It was a real surprise when I tried to follow in their footsteps, and I went to college and I went and got a master's degree, but I still have to put off having my own home, having my own family, because I haven't been able to maintain a good career.
Someone in Seattle says, in a word, no. My father was a professor and my mother was a stay-at-home mom raising five children. But what about you? We'd love to hear your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or just go to the Takeaway's Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend, folks. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.